In one of those subtle shifts of fortune whose effects only become clear much later, the focus of the Mediterranean War now shifted from east to west in the summer of 1808. On May the 2nd, Spain, who'd been a friend to France, then an ally, then a slave, rose against Napoleon. It was an ill-organized uprising, without clear objectives, and for several years it was unclear whether it would succeed. But it crucially forced Bonaparte to turn his attention from events elsewhere, and slowly but surely it drew more and more of his resources away from planned attacks on Sicily, Turkey, and Egypt. Collingwood was quick to exploit the situation. By the second week of June he was already at Cadiz, offering the Spanish the support of his fleet. His arrival combined pathos and farce. 40,000 people turned out to cheer him, not just because the British were potential liberators, but because his magnanimous conduct towards Spanish sailors after Trafalgar had won him an admiring reputation. He advised the Junta on defensive measures and offered to aid the uprising by harrying French coastal defences. Then, when they asked him if he could spare them any gunpowder, he scoured the fleet for supplies. Shortly afterwards, the same gunpowder was used to illuminate Cadiz for the feast of a local saint. Collingwood was not amused. Even now, in his decline, Collingwood took the time to bring on young talent, though from his own pen we hear more of his failures than his successes. "But you may have heard," he wrote, "that I am reckoned rather queer in the promotion of young men. I advance a great many who have not a friend to speak for them, whilst those I respect most in the world sometimes plead in vain. Those who are diligent and promise to be useful officers never miscarry. And if your friend is such a one, send him to me. Mrs. Currell's son never can be a sailor. He has something very odd in his manner, or rather, he has no manner at all, but saunters a melancholic for a week together, unnoticing and unnoticed, except when I give him a little rally to make his blood circulate. And this I do not in the expectation that it will make him better in his profession, but merely for his health's sake. It is a pity she had not put him apprentice to Jonathan Wilson, the apothecary. He might have gone on very wisely. His gravity would have established his reputation as a learned doctor. And if he did poison an old woman now and then, better do that than drown an entire ship's company at a dash by running us on the rocks. P.S. Bounce desires his best respects to your dogs." If his junior officers felt the lash of his wit, they were not alone. He thought little more of generals of whom he had bitter experience from Boston to the Bosphorus. Of a fellow Northumbrian he wrote to his sister, "Do you think of your cousin General Clavering? What a delightful head that man must have for the front rank of an army. It needs no helmet. They might hack their swords to saws without harm to it. I always thought Sir Thomas had the most distinguished head in that family, but I've evidently been mistaken." Meanwhile, both he and the British government, seizing the moment, realized that now was their chance to utilize a former asset in Minorca. And by September 1808, as Sir Arthur Wellesley, later the Duke of Wellington, was making his first grand entrance onto the European stage at Vimiero in Portugal, the Spanish again allowed the British fleet to anchor there and repair their ships. It was a vital advantage. The island had long been recognized as strategically valuable to any country which could possess it. Not only did it lie centrally between Spain, France, Italy, and Corsica and Sardinia, but it boasted the finest deep-water harbour in the Mediterranean at Mahon. In the late 17th century, the British had established a naval facility there, a careening station for cleaning ships' hulls, an ordnance yard and hospital, and other port services. For much of the 18th century, Minorca remained a British possession under a variety of sometimes just, sometimes arrogant governors. For the last 2 years of his life, Collingwood was frequently at Port Mahon, a place he knew well from his days in HMS Liverpool. It was a convenient place to gather intelligence and from which to conduct his complicated naval and diplomatic strategies. He still held the increasingly faint hope that he could catch a large French fleet at sea and defeat them decisively, having several times already narrowly missed them because of bad weather or poor intelligence. Having a fleet at Port Mahon gave him one last chance, and in 1809 he took it. Oddly, it was on October the 21st, 1809, the fourth anniversary of Trafalgar, that news came of the French leaving Toulon. In an action off Rosas Bay, on a smaller scale, but nevertheless important, 5 French convoy ships were burned and 2 ships of the line were driven ashore. At what point Collingwood took or bought the house then called El Fonduco, between Mahon and Villa Carlos, now Escastel, is not known. He usually stayed aboard his flagship, first Ocean, then Ville de Paris. But at some point during the autumn of 1809 he came ashore and stayed for a substantial period. Doctors advised him to try riding a horse and taking a little exercise. A letter, written perhaps from El Fonduco, now called Collingwood House, in January 1810, shows that it was the longest spell he had spent ashore since leaving England nearly 7 years before. By now poor Bounce was dead, having been washed overboard during a storm on the Toulon blockade. He, or a successor with the same name, had been with Collingwood for 19 years. His master would not be long in following. Collingwood House was a perfect shore base. It lay a mile to the southeast of Mahon, away from crowds and noisy sailors. It overlooked a secure anchorage where he could see his flagship. It was large and comfortable, with enough room for conferences with his captains and local politicians. A short walk to the clifftop, and a set of rock-hewn steps brought him down to the cove of El Fonduco, from where his bargemen could row him out to his ship with a minimum of fuss. Sick, tired, and knowing he was dying, and after repeated requests to return to England had, very flatteringly, been turned down, Collingwood resigned his command on February the 22nd, 1810, and on the 25th was rowed out to his ship. She was windbound for a few days, but finally, on March the 6th, she was warped out of the harbour and set sail for England. Collingwood died the next evening at sea. In the wars against Napoleon from 1793 until 1815, Britain was able to rely on four great commanders who, among many thousands of soldiers and sailors, were preeminent in their vision, skills, bravery and sense of duty. They followed each other in an exact sequence. First, Earl St. Vincent, architect of British naval strategy. Then Nelson, brilliant battle commander and unsubtle but effective diplomatist. On Nelson's death, Collingwood became the supreme commander of the effort against Napoleon, and on his death, the focus of the war moved squarely to the Iberian Peninsula, where Wellington would triumph 3 years later. In summing up the achievements of Collingwood's last years, one historian has written, "The naval history of the years after Trafalgar is not of battles. The fights were small, fierce encounters of sloops and gunboats, cutting out expeditions, attacks on batteries. Only once did the enemy come out in force. Yet the scale was heroic, and over the vast canvas towers the figure of Collingwood." In the Newcastle Courant of April the 21st, 1810, we read, "A mail from Gibraltar and Cadiz arrived on Tuesday. It has brought intelligence which will be received with the deepest concern, viz. The death of our highly distinguished and gallant townsman, Admiral Lord Collingwood. His health had long been in declining state, but he persisted in keeping the sea, being anxious to bring the Toulon fleet to action, and by the defeat of the last naval force of the enemy to complete the destruction of the French navy. At length his health declined so much that he was under the necessity of determining to return to England. It pleased heaven, however, that he should see his native land no more. On the 6th he left Minorca, on board the Ville de Paris, and on the 7th he breathed his last. Leaving only two daughters, the title dies with his lordship, but his services will forever live in the memory of a grateful country." And then a week later, "On Saturday last, the Nereus frigate arrived at the Great Nore with the remains of the late Lord Collingwood. They are now lying in state in the Royal Hospital for Seamen at Greenwich, and are to be entombed in St. Paul's Cathedral with those of his lordship's illustrious friend and commander, Nelson. A monument will be erected by the public in the same place in grateful memory of his services." Collingwood is not only commemorated in St. Paul's, but also at Tynemouth, and there is a cenotaph in St. Nicholas's Cathedral in Newcastle, on which, every Trafalgar Day, a wreath is laid in his honour. A bust looks down from the site of his birthplace on the side. His house can still be seen at Morpeth, and in 1,000 Northumbrian hedgerows grow the oaks that he planted, so that his country should never again want for warships.